أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Surah 48, Al-Fath. Title. The title Al-Fath is taken from the opening verse of the surah and denotes the subject matter of this surah, which discusses the great victory bestowed by Allah upon the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, and Muslims in the form of Hudaybiyah Treaty. Period of Revelation. Reports unanimously state that this surah was sent down in Zulqa'dah, 6 after Hijri, when the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, was on his way back to Medina after having concluded the treaty with the Meccan unbelievers. Circumstantial setting. The context of this surah is that one day the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, saw in his dream that he would visit Mecca alongside his companions and perform Umrah there. A prophet's dream is not unreal, rather it is one of the modes of divine revelation sent down to him. Allah confirms this truth in verse 27 of the surah, which states that Allah had shown this dream to his messenger. The dream was thus a divine suggestion that the prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, was obliged to follow. Acting on that dream, however, appeared impossible in the given conditions. The unbelieving Quraysh had barred Muslims from visiting the Kaaba for the last 6 years. In all those years, they had not allowed any Muslim to approach the precincts of the Kaaba to perform Hajj or Umrah. It thus seemed highly unlikely that they would let the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, and a group of his companions enter Mecca for that purpose. The donning of Ihram on the part of Muslims and their proceeding towards Mecca with arms would amount to a declaration of war. Were they to march unarmed, their lives might be in danger. In such circumstances, it was unclear how to act on the divine suggestion. However, being the messenger of Allah, it was the Prophet's duty to follow every command of Allah without hesitation. Accordingly, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, recounted his dream to the companions and readied them for the journey to Mecca. He informed the tribes in the vicinity of Medina of his Umrah visit and openly invited them to join him if they so wished. Those given to a superficial view of things construed his announcement to be self-destructive and refused to accompany him. In contrast, those who had firm faith in Allah and his messenger disregarded the impending dangers and rushed to follow the divine suggestion. So nothing deterred the companions from accompanying the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, and 1,400 of them joined him in this hazardous venture. In early Zulqa'dah, 6 after Hijri, this blessed caravan proceeded from Medina. On reaching Zu'al-Halifa, all of them donned ihram. They carried 70 sacrificial camels with collars around their necks. Each one carried a sword, as was customary for pilgrims at that time. They did not have any other war equipment. Chanting the pilgrimage formula, they set out for the Kaaba. It was commonly known that the Muslims and the unbelieving Quraysh shared a mutual hostility. Only a year before, in Shawwal 5 after Hijri, the unbelieving Quraysh, together with some Arab tribes, had invaded Medina in the famous Battle of Al-Ahzab. Thus, when the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, and a large number of his companions proceeded towards Mecca, which was teeming with those who were after his blood, the march attracted the attention of all Arabia. It was also common knowledge that the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, was not marching to Mecca for war, but rather was guiding his fellow Muslims on their way to the Kaaba in a sacred month of pilgrimage, without any arms and bringing sacrificial camels. The Quraysh were taken aback by the Prophet's step. Zulqa'dah was one of the sacred months, which had been regarded for centuries as a holy month for performing pilgrimage, and no one had the right to bar any pilgrim caravan that donned ihram and was on its way to perform Hajj or Umrah. In accordance with the customs of Arabia, even a tribe otherwise hostile to the members of the passing caravan could not bar them passage. The Quraysh was thus in a dilemma. Were they to thwart the Medinan caravan by force, preventing its entry into Mecca, It would outrage all of Arabia, who would condemn the act as an excess committed by the Quraysh. The Arab tribes would construe it as the Quraysh's monopoly over the Kaaba. Moreover, they would assume that, henceforth, their performance of pilgrimage would be entirely at the discretion of the Quraysh. Such a blunder on the part of the Quraysh would jeopardize their ties with all the tribes in Arabia. On the other hand, if they let the Prophet's caravan enter Mecca, it would strike a severe blow to their prestige. The allowance of safe entry would be interpreted as the Quraysh's weakness. After much deliberation, the Quraysh yielded to their Jahiliyyah notions and resolved not to let the Prophet's caravan enter Mecca at any cost. This decision was driven by their false notions of egotism and prestige. The Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, had assigned a member of the Qab tribe to act as his informer on the Quraysh's strategy and movements. When the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, arrived at Usfan, he apprised him of the Quraysh's full readiness to fight and their encampment at Zutwa. He was further informed that they had already dispatched an advance battalion comprising 200 riders led by Khalid ibn al-Walid to Qura al-Ghamim with the objective of barring the Prophet's party from moving farther. It was the Quraysh's plan to provoke the Prophet's party to military action, which would enable them to declare that the Prophet's party had been there only to fight and that the performance of Umrah and the donning of the Ihram was only a pretext to this end, a ploy to conceal their real intent. Upon receiving this information, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, immediately changed his route, and after traversing difficult terrain and undergoing much hardship, his party reached Hudaybiyah, a place close to the Kaaba. The chief of the Khuza tribe, Budayl ibn Warqa, along with some of his tribesmen, called on the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, and inquired about the purpose of his visit. He replied, "We are not here to fight against anyone. Our only objective is to visit the Kaaba and to perform tawaf there." They conveyed the same message to the Quraysh chiefs and advised them not to create any obstacles in the path of the Prophet's party. However, the latter clung to their stance and they sent Hulais ibn Alkama, the chief of the Ahabish, to persuade the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, to return to Medina. The Quraysh chiefs calculated that after the chief received the Prophet's refusal to follow his advice, he would also turn hostile to the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, and this would provide their cause with the additional help and support of Ahabish. However, Hulais saw with his own eyes that all the members of the Prophet's caravan were in the state of Ihram, bringing their sacrificial camels. It convinced him that they were only there for pilgrimage, not for fighting. So he returned to Mecca without even speaking to the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him. He plainly told the Quraysh chiefs that the Prophet's party was only on its way to Umrah out of their tremendous regard for the Kaaba. He added, "If you attack them, we, the Ahabish, will not lend you any support. Our alliance with you is not for committing any sacrilege against the sanctities." Urwa ibn Masud Thaqafi called on the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, as the Quraysh's emissary. He tried to the best of his capacity to persuade the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, to give up his plan of entering Mecca. The Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, gave him the same reply he had conveyed earlier to the Khuza tribal chief, that the Muslims had not arrived there to fight. Rather, as devotees to the house of Allah, they were there to perform their religious duties. Upon his return, Urwa told the Quraysh chiefs, "I have been to the courts of Caesar, Khosros, and Negus. However, by God, I have not seen any of their courtiers so much devoted to their kings as the Prophet's companions have tremendous regard for him. I saw in his cab some unprecedented scenes. As Muhammad does ablution, his companions do not let even a drop of water used by him fall on the ground. They readily collect all water and rub it on their clothes and bodies. Now think again, you are pitting yourselves against someone who is held in such great esteem." While these negotiations with emissaries were underway, the Quraysh kept trying to provoke the Prophet's camp into taking some action that would provide them with a pretext for launching war. However, on each such occasion, the Prophet's forbearance and wisdom and the companion's self-restraint and discipline foiled these attempts. One night, 40 to 50 members of the Quraysh sneaked into the Prophet's camp and hurled stones. The companions caught them and brought them before the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, who released them. On another day, 80 persons from Tanim descended on the Muslim camp at the time of Fajr prayer. They too were captured. However, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, set them free. Thus, all the attempts of the Quraysh came to nothing. Finally, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, sent Uthman as his envoy to Mecca, conveying this message to the Quraysh chiefs that the Muslims were there not to fight, but to visit the Kaaba while bringing their sacrificial camels. He assured the Quraysh that they would depart after performing tawaf and animal sacrifice. However, the Quraysh did not budge, and they detained Uthman in Mecca. In the meantime, a rumor about Uthman's assassination spread. As he had not returned to the Muslim camp, the Muslims took this rumor at face value and could no longer restrain themselves. They had never considered the option of entering Mecca by force, but now their only option was to fight in response to the murder of the Prophet's envoy. The Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, assembled all of his companions and made them pledge that they would not retreat until they died. It was an extraordinary pledge in view of the gravity of the situation. The Muslims numbered only 1,400 and they were unarmed. They were camped right at the entrance to Mecca, 250 miles away from home. At any moment, the enemy could swoop on them with all of its might. They could be surrounded by the tribes who were the allies of the Quraysh. Notwithstanding all these adverse conditions, all the companions but one unhesitatingly pledged their allegiance at the Prophet's hands, vowing to lay down their lives in this cause. It was an eloquent testimony to their sincere faith and devotion to the cause of Allah. This pledge came to be known in Islamic history as the fealty of Allah's good pleasure, Baitul Rizwan. Later on, it emerged that the report about Uthman's assassination was false. Uthman did return along with the Quraysh delegation led by Suhail ibn Amr to discuss a peace treaty. The Quraysh now no longer insisted that the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, and his companions could not enter Mecca. However, to save face, they proposed that the Muslims leave now and visit Mecca next year to perform Umrah. The following conditions were part of the peace treaty, which was drafted after extensive negotiations. 1. There will be no war between the two parties for 10 years. They will not carry out any overt or covert hostile actions against each other. 2. During the above period, if any person from the Quraysh seeks shelter with Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, without his guardian's consent, he will be returned to the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him. If any of the Prophet's companions go to the Quraysh, they will not be returned. 3. Any Arab interested in joining this treaty as an ally of either party is free to do so. 4. Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, will return home this year, but can stay in Mecca for 3 days next year in order to perform Umrah, provided he carries only one sheathed sword and no other weapon. The Meccans will vacate the town for those 3 days in order to avoid any clash. On his return, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, will not be authorized to take any Meccan from Mecca. While these conditions were under discussion, the Muslim camp was much disturbed. No one could understand why the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, had agreed to such conditions. They could not foresee the immense benefits that would accrue from this treaty. The unbelieving Quraysh took the treaty as their victory, whereas the Muslims felt perplexed as to why they should accept such degrading conditions. Even such an astute person as Umar remarked, "After embracing Islam, this was the only occasion when some doubt gnawed at me. In an agitated state, I went to Abu Bakr and asked him, "Is the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, not the Messenger of Allah? Are we not Muslims? Are they not polytheists? Why should we then reconcile to such debasing conditions regarding our faith?" To this he replied, "O Umar, he is the Messenger of Allah. Allah will not let him down." Even this did not pacify Umar. He went to the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, and posed the same questions to him. The Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, gave him the same reply that Abu Bakr, may Allah be pleased with him, had given. At a later date, Umar regretted the questions he had posed to the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him. In expiation, he gave in charity and offered extra prayers so that Allah might forgive him. The following two provisions of the treaty troubled the Muslims most. Its provision regarding the return of Makkah seemed unfair to them. If the Muslims were obliged to return those fleeing from Makkah, the Makkans too should be asked to return those fleeing from Medina. To this, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, replied, "If anyone flees us and goes there, he is worthless to us. It is better that he should leave us. As for those who we return, Allah will find a way out for them." The other objectionable provision of the treaty regarded to their return to Medina without performing Umrah this year. For them, it spelled their humiliation in the eyes of all Arabs. Furthermore, it was a disturbing thought for them that they had to return without doing tawaf in Makkah in light of the Prophet's dream that they would do so. The Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, reasoned with them thus, "It was not specified in the dream that we would do tawaf this year. In accordance with the treaty, we shall, inshallah, perform tawaf next year." While the peace treaty was being drafted, an incident added fuel to the fire. Abu Jandal, the son of the Quraysh delegation's Suhail ibn Amr, reached the Prophet's camp. He had accepted Islam and had been under the custody of the unbelieving Meccans. When he reached the camp, he was in fetters, and signs of torture could be seen all over his body. He pleaded fervently to the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, for release from his illegal confinement. It was hard for the companions to witness his plight. Suhail ibn Amr pointed out that although the draft treaty had not been signed, they had agreed in principle that a fleeing Meccan would be returned by the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him. He accordingly demanded that his son be handed over to him. The Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, upheld his side of the agreement, and Abu Jandal was restored to his persecutors. After concluding the treaty, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, directed the companions to sacrifice their animals and to take off their ihram. However, no one moved. He gave the command three times, yet the companions were overcome by so much grief and frustration that they did not follow his order. This was the only instance of such behavior on the companions' part in the whole of the Prophet's career. On every other occasion, they rushed to follow his commands. This exceptional behavior naturally hurt him, and he expressed his displeasure to his wife, Umm Salama. She suggested that he should go ahead and sacrifice the camel and get his hair shaved. All the companions would then readily follow his example, realizing that his decision was binding and irrevocable. He followed this advice and, on observing his conduct, the companions too offered their animal sacrifices, had their hair shaved or cut, and took off their ihram. They were still grief-stricken. While they were on their way back to Medina, thinking of their defeat and humiliation at concluding the peace treaty, this surah was sent down to the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, at Dajnan, or according to some, at Qura al-Ghamim. This surah told the Muslims that the treaty, which they regard as their defeat, constituted their great victory. After the revelation of the surah, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, assembled his companions and told them, "Today, what has been sent down to me is more valuable for me than all that there is in this world." He then recited this surah before them. He asked Umar in particular to listen to the surah, as Umar was most grieved by the treaty. The believers felt reassured by the divine revelation, and they soon witnessed the tremendous benefits accruing from the treaty. Everyone quickly realized that it represented a great victory for them. Its advantages included the following. 1. This treaty established the first recognition of the Islamic State of Medina. Prior to this, Arabs in general looked upon the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, and his companions as rebels and outlaws against the Quraysh and their confederates. As the Quraysh entered into this agreement with the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, by recognizing his rule over the territory of the Islamic State, they also opened the gate for other Arab tribes to form alliances with the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, as the treaty acknowledged that he represented a political power in his own right. 2. As the Quraysh acknowledged the Muslims' right to visit the Kaaba, they accepted Islam as a legitimate faith, when previously they had been unwilling to do so. As they thus affirmed it as one of the faiths in Arabia, Muslims too were entitled to perform Hajj and Umrah like the adherents of other faiths. This contributed to removing some of the hostility of the Arabs towards Islam, which had been aroused by the Quraysh's anti-Islam propaganda. 3. The 10-year pact of non-aggression blessed the Muslims with peace and enabled them to preach Islam across Arabia unhindered. As a result, within 2 years of the treaty's signing, the number of Muslims grew by more than the total number of converts to Islam had been in the 19 years prior to the treaty. At the time of the treaty, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, was accompanied by 1,400 Muslims. When he attacked Mecca for the Quraysh's breach of the treaty 2 years later, he had a 10,000-strong army. 4. After the non-aggression pact with Quraysh, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, had an excellent opportunity to consolidate this control over the territories won by Muslims. His enforcement of Islamic law there helped Muslim society assimilate Islamic culture. The Quran speaks of this blessing thusly: "This day I have perfected for you your religion, and completed my favor upon you, and have approved for you Islam as your religion." Al-Ma'idah 5:3. 5. Once the treaty guaranteed peace on the southern frontier, the Muslims were able to overcome easily those hostile to them in central and northern Arabia. Only 3 months after the treaty, Khaybar, the biggest fort of the Jews, was captured. The Muslims then gained control over the Jewish settlements in Fadak, Wadi al-Qura, Tema' and Tabuk. All the tribes of central Arabia who had colluded with the Quraysh and the Jews were gradually won over. In sum, the treaty changed the balance of power heavily in favor of the Muslims, relegating the Quraysh and the polytheists to a secondary position. It made the ascendancy of Islam imminent. These were some of the blessings that Muslims received from the treaty they had misperceived to be to their disadvantage and favorable to the Quraysh. What offended Muslims most, and what the Quraysh regarded as their victory, was the issue of the return of those fleeing from Mecca to Medina. The treaty stipulated that those escaping from Mecca to Medina would be returned to Mecca, whereas those going from Medina to Mecca would not be returned. Within a short time, this provision cost the Quraysh dearly. It soon became clear that the Prophet's acceptance of this provision of the treaty was sagacious. A few days after the treaty, a Meccan Muslim, Abu Basir, managed to escape from the custody of the Quraysh and got to Medina. The Quraysh demanded that Abu Basir be returned, and the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, complied, restoring him to the envoys deputed from Mecca for his return. However, on the way back to Mecca, Abu Basir escaped again and encamped on the route leading to the Red Sea coast. This was the Quraysh's trade route. He was joined there by all those Muslims who had escaped the Quraysh's custody in Mecca. Rather than going to Medina, they assembled at Abu Basir's camp, with at one point 70 Muslims gathered there. Their constant raids made life difficult for the Quraysh. Eventually, the Quraysh asked the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, to resettle the Muslims with Abu Basir in Medina. Thus, this provision of the treaty was eventually rendered null and void.